is old and as true as the sky. And the wolf that shall keep it may prosper, but the wolf that shall break it must die. As the creeper that girdles the tree trunk, the law runneth forward and back. For the strength of the pack is the wolf, and the strength of the wolf is the pack. Now, first of all, you have to give me credit for quoting poetry at a technical conference. But what does The Law of the Jungle by Rudyard Kipling have to do with engaging naysayers? Well, for me, it's got everything to do with Mick Jagger. And not so much Mick Jagger the person, but more Mick Jagger the rock star. And in our industry, we know them when we see them, and rock stars are fantastic to work with. Because for rock stars, you can give them a laptop that's 10 years old, a dial-up internet connection with vague requirements, and they'll still produce you a quality deliverable. Because for them, quality is second nature. Quality is merely a byproduct of what they do. And interestingly enough, at the keynote, Dave Fellows from Azure Batch said they were hiring. And he didn't say, I'm looking for senior developers with 15 years experience in the industry. He said, I want rockstar coders. And unfortunately, rockstar coders are far and few between. And as Kipling says, the strength of the wolf is the pack. Well, how's the pack doing? According to Gallup, not so well. Now, Gallup is an annual engagement survey which, surprisingly enough, measures engagement of employees across organisation. And Gallup tells us that 73% of professional workers in Australia and New Zealand are actively disengaged or not engaged. Actively disengaged or not engaged. As a project manager, by the way, of the two of us up here today, my name is Judy Virtue and I'm a project manager. As a project manager, that number scares the crap out of me. It means if I have a team of 10 people, 7 of them are actively disengaged or not engaged. And if I'm lucky enough to have one rock star in the remaining 3, well, that's not enough. One rock star can't carry 7 people. That would be like, you know, Mick Jagger putting on a concert with me and 6 of my tone-deaf mates singing backup. Nobody's enjoying that gig. That's not a quality concert. So what do we do about it? Well, look, I'm an optimist, and the glass is half full. And I fundamentally believe if you can provide a rock star environment, then you can get a rock star performance out of anyone. And you can get those people that aren't natural rock stars performing at that rock star level. Well, that's when good teams can become great.
Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night. Okay, I'm not going to continue. This is just ridiculous. It's a tech conference. I'm not going to quote poetry. But Julian is actually really good at pushing his team at doing something that is really fantastic and really good. And this is a perfect example where I saw him doing a little bit of poetry. I'm like, maybe I should do the same. I want to be, you know, up there trying a new challenge, but not for a tech conference. It's not for me. It's interesting that he called them rock stars. If anyone went to Laura Butler's session yesterday, she was talking about people with superpowers and kryptonite as their weakness. Now, to me, I refer to them as superheroes. This is a picture of me and my colleagues at Oktoberfest last year. And as you can see, we're all dressed like superheroes, including myself. I'm the second from the left. And I'm dressed up like Bruce Wayne. That's right. And funny enough, my son is wearing a t-shirt that says, my dad is a superhero. In case you haven't noticed, my son is the baby, not any one of the other ones. But it's not enough to be dressed like superheroes. We actually wanted a little bit more. We didn't want to act like superheroes. We wanted to be superheroes. Although they're quite convincing. If you look at the one on your left, we have Mexican Superman. If you look at the one on the other hand, we have mullet Captain Planet. So it's really believable, but I wanted them to do more, and I knew that they were capable to do more. At that stage, I was tech lead. My name is Rami. I'm currently a solution architect, but back then, I was working under Julian's project management skills, and I was tech leading my friends in here. And to me, when I look at the code that they produced, they looked like they were in a comfort zone. So they looked something like that. They were comfortable, they were in the sun, they were really happy with what was happening. Quite often we would hear things around the office where people would say, hey, it's building on my machine. Things like, oh, my unit tests are passing, and this is not the attitude I wanted. I wanted really rock star or superhero sort of attitude in there. So we had a challenge that we had to resolve. So today we're going to look at that challenge. And the message that I'm going to transmit is this. If you want an engaged team, treat them like rock stars and superheroes. I actually went all the way to start giving them names. So I had my small team. When I first joined, it was quite a large project. And I looked at a few different platforms, if you want. This is what we call them. And they had their own little groups. And I thought, all right, well, those look like the Avengers. Those people over there look like the Fantastic Five, not the Fantastic Four. But then the team that was reporting to me directly, I thought, all right, I'm going to give them names from the Batman universe. So I had Batman. I had Robin. I had Batgirl, I had Catwoman, I even had the Riddler, someone that I didn't really get along with. And then once a week, I would summon them to come into a meeting, and then we would have a look at progress, we would have a look at, you know, the quality that we are producing. And then they're like, summoning Batman, that sounds like Commissioner Gordon's name. And they gave me that name, so I became Commissioner Gordon. And I didn't mind that, that's fine, it's funny, I gave them names myself. But Commissioner Gordon had one goal, and that was to look after Gotham City. And my goal was to look after the quality of the build that we're producing, make sure that we're producing something that is really of high strength and quality. So throughout my career, I actually read quite a lot of books about quality, and you can see them showing up in there. They're actually quite good books. Quite often I get junior developers come to me and say, hey, I want to learn about that latest technology, MVC 11, .NET 9.0, whatever it's called. And they're like, oh, we have that book, and I really want to read it. And I'm like, slow down, hang on. Do you know the basics? Can you tell me what the object-oriented paradigms are? And they go, I've learned about it at university, but that's not something that you use at work. I'm like, of course it is. And they always jump to the latest and the greatest, leading edge, bleeding edge. And then when I read those books, or not those specifically, but the new ones about a specific technology, they give you examples that are specific to the language. And most of the time, they oversimplify it. And it's not best practice to use those in a production environment or an enterprise type of code. Those books will teach you how to program in a language, whereas the books that you see over there, they will teach you how to program into a language. They will tell you what the best practices are. They will tell you how to actually build something that is of high quality. A very good one is Code Complete that I actually recommend to quite a lot of people. It's really good. But the one I want to focus on is The Economics of Software Quality, written by Capus Jones. Capus Jones is a master of software quality. He worked on quite a few projects and has data from thousands of projects, although he didn't work on all of those. He aggregated them from different sources and then came up with metrics. I can guarantee that if you read his book and do a little bit of upfront work, that you're going to go into a project knowing exactly how many defects you're going to get before you even start. This is how good his research is. And then through his research, he showed us quite a few graphs. And one of them is that if you have poor quality code, over time, so over 12 months, is going to start costing you a lot of money to actually maintain and, you know, add things to it and so on. So the curve is quite steep compared to good quality code, which looks more like that. And you can see that there is a breakpoint around the six-month period. And this is actually quite useful, because the rest of the books will give you similar metrics. They will talk about productivity and how, after 6 months, productivity will plummet. And, you know, you ask yourself, but why is that? What's so special about this six-month sort of time frame? And it's because people move on, people leave the company, new people come in, they want to try things in a different way, so different styles as well. But also, people forget. So I like to think as, of my brain as actually a computer, and once in a while I just flush the buffer and I forget everything that happened 6 months ago, and then I start getting all the new information. And then I look at the code and I read something like that. When I wrote this code, only God and I understood what I was doing. Now, God only knows. And it's quite common, and it's quite natural, because after a while, if you write something complex, you're going to forget what you did 6 months ago. And that's why when you have spaghetti code, you have to make sure that you're actually spaghetti code is ugly, it's difficult to maintain. And you actually spend 80% of your time looking at the existing code, and only 20% of your time writing new code. 80% of your time looking at something that is already there. So I think it's only fair to treat it like something that is going to be valuable in the future that you're going to spend 80% of your time on. And that's why it's important to introduce those good practices. One of the things that I do is whenever I have the time to write code, I mean, I really miss writing code now that I'm the solution architect, but I have a policy that I check in twice a day. And before I check in my code, I have a look at every single file that I'm checking in. Quite often, I would be explaining a concept for one of our junior developers or for a team or something, so I, you know, open a file and then start showing them examples on how they can do things better. And those are things that I prefer not to check in, so I undo or I roll back my changes. And then I look at each one of those files and look at them line by line to make sure that I'm doing the right thing. And surprisingly, most of the time, I'm only checking in 2 lines, 4 lines, 5 lines, just very small amount of code that I'm checking in into our repository. And the reason for that is because I spend most of my time understanding the flow of the application. I spend a lot of time looking at the existing libraries, having a look at how I can leverage some of those, deciding exactly where the code should go, but also writing a lot of unit tests to make sure that my code is strong and of high quality. So, you know, that really explains why we're actually spending 80% of our time reading something existing as opposed to writing new code. Now, quite often I get a lot of people that come to me and say, no, it's okay, we'll do it later. And to me, I don't like hearing later, because to me, later equals never. And actually, this is a very famous law called Leblanc's law, so check it out. It is out there. I'm not claiming that it's mine. And I've, you know, with the few years that I had in the industry, I've realized that quite a lot of people just, you know, produce something that is not of fantastic quality, and it never gets reviewed, it never gets fixed. And this is why when they tell you later equals never is something that is dreadful. And then our quality manager comes to me, and he asks me, so you guys, you know, we know we have quite a lot of time pressures. And talking about time, actually, maybe I should ask the audience, how many people in this audience, and I think I know the answer to that, but how many people in the audience work on a project that had very tight time pressures? Okay, I'm just trying to find someone who's not raising their hand, but I'm not gonna do that, no. But yeah, it's quite common in our industry to be, you know, quite tight on time. So my quality manager came to me and he said, all right, well, if you don't have time to do it once, when will you have time to do it over? I was like, wow, this is quite philosophical. This is quite deep. Where did he get that from? Turns out it's actually a famous quote by Coach Wooden. So this is basketball player turned coach John Wooden. And it's completely right. And I want you guys to ask yourself that question. Next time that you're writing code and you're like, it's all right, we'll just do a quick job right now and then we'll fix it later. But if you're, you know, quite tight on time, when are you going to have time to do it over? So this is something that is really important. And because of that, I came up with a new rule that whenever we see technical debt, we say no to technical debt. Unfortunately, people like the project managers did not really like that idea because it was costing us a lot of time and money to actually go and fix technical debt. But that's fine. After a while, it becomes an art to accept that technical debt. Some things you know are not that severe, and you would allow them to go into your code. Some things you know are going to come back and bite you in the ass, so it's something that you have to address and look at. So what I had in mind is, okay, I'm going to produce the quality that I want. Now, how am I going to get there? Throughout the presentation, we're going to talk about a few techniques of doing that. But the first one that I wanted is consistency. We had large teams, we have a lot of people, and we actually wanted to make sure that the code that we're writing, our code base, looked like it was written maybe by one person, but at least it looked like it was written by one team. So introduce a bit of consistency. Now, how can we achieve this consistency? Well, we can have peer reviews. And yeah, that was a good idea. And part of those peer reviews, you might detect things like you're missing unit tests, which is fantastic. And then after you have your unit test, then you start having some information, some data. So at the keynote speaker, James, the keynote speaker, was saying that every organization is now becoming an IT company. And this is completely true, especially of us, people that are in the industry, IT industry. We are a software company. We can get this data, we can look at it, we can understand it, and we can have metrics that would actually tell us there's something wrong or there's something that is looking quite good. Once we have all of that, it's really important to have visibility over those metrics. So make sure that everyone in the team, everyone on the different teams, can have a look at where they stand and decide whether it's good or bad. And then from that, we decide whether we do have consistency or not, and then the cycle continues over and over again. Now, me being a tech lead and Julian being a project manager, we sort of had the same goal that we were working towards. We wanted to produce quality. Now, we knew that if you take a stick and go to a programmer and you say, give me quality, that's not going to work. And, we've proven that many times before, except it wasn't with a stick. So we had different techniques. We had different views that we were looking at. I was in the trenches. I had my sleeves rolled up. I was leading the team. I was doing a lot of development myself. And Julian was looking at it from a different angle. But we were trying to solve the same problem. And in the beginning, we realized we were not working together, and we had completely different techniques to actually resolve that.
So let me tell you a story. You'll find out I like stories. I have a 4-year-old son, and most weekends, we walk to the dairy and back to buy bread and milk. And for me, it's a 5-minute walk, but for him, it's 15 minutes. He's only little, he's got small legs. And 15 minutes there, 15 minutes back, it's a little bit too long, and he can get a bit bored. So, one of the walks, I decided to try something a bit different. Now, the footpath between my house and the dairy looks a little bit like this. And a big shout-out to the one in City Council for helping me out here. So I told my son, instead of walking home from the dairy, we're actually walking through an unexplored land full of volcanoes and dinosaurs. And those cracks in the ground aren't just any cracks. They're actually volcanic cracks, which lava can come out of. And you can't stand on lava because you'll get burnt, which is a fantastic safety tip to tell kids anyway. And he loved it, fully engaged in the process, trying to figure out paths over things, getting me to lift them over the big bits. It was great. Didn't work out so well for me. The 15-minute walk became 45 minutes. And the look I got from this elderly woman as she approached my son when he stopped, looked up and went, "Ah, dinosaur!" Not my finest parenting moment. So what had I done? I painted a picture. I set him a challenge and an objective. I'd essentially gamified the situation. For those of you not familiar with the term, gamification is the art of taking game mechanics and applying it to non-gaming situation. I'll give you an example of the power of those game mechanics. This is a game called Flight Control. I bought it, I played it, I owned it. It's a mobile game. A very simple premise, you're an air traffic controller and you have to land aircraft at a runway. As you progress through the game, the aircraft come in increasing speed and frequency until there's a crash. Air traffic controllers have one of the most stressful jobs in the world. And yet, after a long, hard, stressful day in the office, I'd walk home going, "Wow, I need to relax, need to unwind. I'm going to land some planes." What's my point? My point is you can take any activity, be it walking home from the dairy, be it landing planes on a runway, be it software development. And if you apply the right set of game mechanics, you can make that activity interesting. You can make it engaging. You can make it fun. So why gamification? You can walk into, any bookstore around the world and find hundreds of books on, building great teams and improving engagement. Well, for me, it came about watching a girl called Jane McGonigal. She's fantastic. I highly recommend you Google her. I highly recommend you Bing her. Bing her, you'd get far better results set. She's done some great talks at TED. And in one of her talks, I heard her talk about the power of gamification that really struck a chord with me. And I'm going to share the example now. She spoke about Wikipedia. Wikipedia, after 7 years of existence, commissioned two guys, a man by the name of Clay Shirky and Martin Wedenberg, and asked them to estimate how much time had been invested in building Wikipedia to that point. And they calculated that 100 million hours had been invested building Wikipedia over that seven-year period. If we compare that to a massively popular online game called Call of Duty, Activision, the company that created Call of Duty, released some stats last year, including the number of hours that have been spent playing this game. In Call of Duty, 100 million hours is racked up in little under 9 days. 7 years, 9 days. Now look, I don't think for one second I'm going to get developers walking home, firing up their Xbox and going, hey, you know what, I'm going to log into Datacom, do the extra work, get me that badge. I don't think that's going to happen. But I do think that when they are at the workplace, when they are working, we can create an environment that is far more engaging, far more enjoyable, far more fun.
It was slightly different. So when I started, I was actually looking at it from personal experience. Before I became lazy, I'm not too big, but before I became lazy and spent 9 hours behind a computer screen, I used to be a sprinter. So when I was in high school, I was actually the best in my class. And I liked to run. It was a fun activity for me. It sort of freed my mind. But one thing that I did notice, that I could never beat my personal best unless I was running next to someone. And it's this sort of competitiveness that I had in me that I didn't want to be a loser. I didn't want to be the first loser. I always wanted to be the first in my class. I always wanted to be ahead. So whenever I was running, and there was someone next to me, and I would see them from the side of my eye, even if they were the fastest in their class, and they were getting a little bit ahead of me, the beast in me would unleash, and I would start running as crazy as I can, just so that I'm there first. It's almost like I'm in a safari, and there's a lion behind me, and I would think, if I'm the first loser, then I'm going to be eaten alive. Failure was not an option. So I noticed that it's actually more of a psychological thing. I then had the same experiences once I started playing video games when I was playing racing video games. And whenever you're doing a practice, you have that option of having a ghost car. And I would see that ghost car, which is the car that I drove like, you know, a lap before, getting ahead of me. And I was trying to beat it the whole time so that I can beat my personal best. So I thought, all right, let's use a little bit of psychology and maybe implement that within the team. So this is where we're trying to produce the quality as second nature of the people that we have, as opposed to being something as a direct goal. And I thought, all right, well, maybe what we need to do is a little bit of sort of competitiveness at work. Now, competitiveness, not really rivalry, because I didn't want people to have grudges and, you know, be losers or something like that. This is one thing that I've noticed when I came to New Zealand, that everyone is a winner. So this is what I wanted to do. I wanted everyone in my team, or actually everyone in all the teams, to be winners, everyone to be at the same level. Now, just to prove a point, I'm going to do a small experiment with everyone in the audience. So I would appreciate if everyone would participate. It's actually a really simple thing. I want everyone to put their hand up as high up as they possibly can. Okay, now put it even higher. What was that about? So Julian got on the chair, which is probably the best that he can do. But this is to prove a point that everyone was actually in a comfort zone going, yeah, I'm comfortable here. And then I said, all right, give me more. And you're like, yeah, I can do that. And this is what I wanted to get from my team, is to actually give that extra 5 and 10% that would make a big difference. Now, again, as they said in the keynote speaker, it's all about data. So we thought, all right, well, let's put it in numbers. How can I tell if a team is actually winning or not if we don't have some sort of numbers? So we wanted to see that, you know, we are at that position and we are at this position and so on. So we thought, all right, I'm a tech lead. I care about the code. I check in my code. It goes somewhere. Builds trigger. Unit test trigger. They pass. They fail. Things happen. And then we get metrics. We get static analysis that gives us numbers. Where is that? Where can I get it from? Well, of course, it's all in TFS. for me, it was really easy. I could just go to TFS, retrieve all those metrics, and have them on a nice sort of reporting spreadsheet or a dashboard or something like that, and then tell the team, this is where we are. However, Julian had a slightly different challenge.
I did, but I also wanted to use TFS, not so much as a repository for source code, but the repository for the work items, the work breakdown, the tasks, the features, user stories. And I'm pleased to say that for the past 18 months, I've had 60 people coming to work every day and playing a game. And yeah, Datacom management loves it when I say that in front of clients.
We do have some of Datacom management in the audience. Yeah, I can spot one person.
And I'm going to show you what the game looked like a little bit in a minute. But first off, when we started, the problems we were trying to solve were pretty small. It was just, let's create a culture of using TFS. Let's get people updating. Let's get people putting estimates in there. Let's get people just using it. So it wasn't really, not strenuous challenges to begin with. And also, one of the principles I had for the first version of the game was it had to be a background process. I wanted it to run behind the scenes so it didn't interfere with people's day-to-day lives. And if people didn't want to play, they didn't have to. So it looked a little bit like this. So this is the homepage, it's a basic website, officially known as Badges. You can see people's avatars up there with their current points for the current game. On the right-hand side, you've got kind of an RSS-style feed giving the last 10 badges, who's won what. And on the top is sort of the menu indicating some of the mechanics that we used, with some of the game mechanics. This website every 5 minutes would poll TFS. And it would run a query for every single badge we created to determine if anyone had, you know, achieved that badge and then award them. So I'll take you through some of the mechanics. PBLs, points, badges, leaderboards, they're kind of the ABCs of a lot of gamification implementations, and we certainly use them. So these are three badges that we had. We had about 40 to 45 active, and that was really just scraping the surface what we could do. So, you know, if you perform an activity, you'll get a badge. So, you know, you perform a code review, a document review, you'll get the review badge. Update TFS 3 days in a row, three in a row. Finish 10 tasks, tenfold. It's not rocket science. With badges come points. And the more points the badge has, the more valuable the badge. I've got two types of points up there. So there's 75p, 75 points, and 50d. Now 50d is dollars, dollars spelt with an H and a U and a Z. I'll let you figure out where those letters went. And it's a virtual currency, so you can use it to buy things. So with points come leaderboards. So this is kind of a munge of three screenshots giving the top 45 players. We had all different types of leaderboards. So you had a lifetime leaderboard, you had a leaderboard for the game, you had leaderboards for all players, you had a leaderboard just for the current team, and all various combinations of those together. And this is our reward shop. So, you know, coffee, cold drinks, chocolate, lunch, movie tickets, and I encourage the team to give me ideas, give me suggestions, and I can throw them in there for people to achieve what they wanted. Game periods, very key metric. You need to reset the game periodically. So if you're playing for 18 months and someone joins the team after six, and they look at a leaderboard and see somebody miles ahead of them, they're never going to catch them, and they've got no interest, and they become demotivated and don't want to play. The exact opposite effect that what we wanted. So you need a chance for everyone to start on a level playing field. So when we started, we were very much an agile sprint-based world, so we just aligned the game periods to our sprints. So every 2 or 3 weeks, we'd reset the scores to zero. Everyone had a chance to play against each other again. Challenges. The challenges are one of my favorite mechanics for two reasons. One, they can completely change the dynamic of the game. So challenges allow you to throw an ad hoc mission or an ad hoc quest out of left field. And if you're playing a game over and over again, you kind of get used to the mechanics, you kind of get used to what's going on, and you get a bit boring. If you throw one of these in, it just changes the feel of the game. It can break up the monotony a bit. And secondly, I love team challenges. Look, inherent in gamification is a bit of competitiveness, and that's fine. A little bit of competition within a team is okay, but I don't want too much. I far prefer collaboration. I far prefer a team coming together to solve a problem. And with team challenges, you can certainly do that. When we first started, as I said, the challenges we were going to try and meet were getting people to update TFS. So there were simple things to do. I looked at TFS the month before we started playing the game, and we didn't look too good, as you saw earlier. I then looked at the month after we started playing TFS, and we looked a little bit better. And I found that we had a 42% improvement in the number of times TFS was being updated, which was fantastic for me as a PM because it meant people that were updating their tasks once a week were now updating them daily or even multiple times in a day. And it gave me greater insight to see where the team, how they were doing, where they were tracking against milestones. About 3 days in to playing the game, I had a tester come to my desk. And she's very, very, very talented, but she's been described as possibly a little bit ornery, a little bit grumpy, and she was absolutely the top of my list of people that would not play this, would not care, roll her eyes, and move on. Anyway, she came to my desk after hours. She's like, "Jules, I like what you've done. Not really for me, but it's good. Now, first of all, I don't want the badge. I don't need the badge. But I updated TFS and I didn't get the badge. And if I'm not getting the badge, then someone else probably isn't getting the badge, and they probably want the badge. You probably need to fix your code to make sure they get it." And I had her. I had the ultimate naysayer playing my game. And it was a real watershed moment for me. So look, as we progressed through the project and progressed through playing, we came across different challenges. The next major problem we faced was a consistent burn down. So the example is, if someone works for 7 hours during a day, you expect the burn down to be reduced by 7 hours. Again, not rocket science. What was happening is people were putting 7 hours in, but the burn down was going down by 5 hours, or maybe 6 hours. And this was a big enough problem that we had to address it. So I came up with the perfect day badge. Very, very simple. If you work 7 hours in a day, the burn down needs to be reduced by 7 hours, and you get awarded the badge. I looked at the 2 months before I awarded or issued the badge, and we weren't looking too good. I then looked at the 2 months after I created the badge, and we looked a little bit better. And we had a 25% improvement in the number of perfect days, which for me showed a greater level of ownership. It meant that developers, testers, analysts were taking the estimates they were giving and delivering against them, which was fantastic for me as a PM. Now, a lot of you in the audience will be sitting there going, "Well, this is all well and good." To be fair, I hope everyone in the audience is going, "This is all well and good." But you're probably going, "It's not really a game, right? You perform activity X, you get badge X. You perform activity Y, you get badge Y. It's a reward system." So I decided to change things. And this is really the next version of the game for me. I introduced another point system called gold. So not only did you earn points and dollars, you now started earning gold. And with gold, you could create a virtual zoo. The virtual zoo would allow you to get virtual animals. Virtual animals would attract virtual visitors. And you could charge visitors gold to come see your zoo. And suddenly we had a game loop. Now, I did this absolutely knowing that people would spend 10 to 15 minutes a day playing this game. And my argument always has been, if I've got an engaged person for 7.25 hours versus a disengaged person for 7.5 hours, I'm taking the engaged person every day of the week and twice on Sunday. It's not really a choice for me. Anyway, this is what the zoo looked like. Well, this is kind of my zoo after a couple of weeks playing. You've got pathways around, you've got some basic animals, you've got visitors walking around. The developer at the time was fantastic. He really bought into it. He created an entire weather system. It rains, it snows, the grass turns into icy tundra. It's brilliant. And as we progressed, obviously, more and more people got involved and more zoos got built, and I got some pretty cool screenshots, and this is my favorite. Somebody really likes ducks.
Okay. Yeah, so my technology was probably not as advanced as Julian. So I didn't use technology, as you saw. I used Excel. I don't know if you guys consider Excel technology, but to me, it's something very basic. So what we had is a dev manager that would summon all the teams, all the tech leads, and once a week, he would get them together and then just talk about the progress and talk about quality, pretty much what I did with my specific team. And one day he decided to start that spreadsheet, and it was around week 10. During week 10, he came into that meeting and he handed us some printouts, and it had squares. Now, there's platforms on the right-hand side, and at the top for the columns, we had weeks. And when we first started, everything was red. And we're like, "Well, red? Next to my platform name? I don't want to be red. What is that all about?" And he said, all right, what we're going to introduce is some sort of metrics and visibility to see where we're at. And the first rule was that if your build is broken, then it's going to be red. Or even if you don't have a build, then it's going to be red, a red square next to your platform. If we have a build that is working, but unit tests that fail, then we go amber. And then after that, if we have a build that works and unit tests that pass, then we go green. And then being in New Zealand, tall poppy syndrome, everyone's like, whatever. We don't want to be the first one to go green. So everyone was happy being red. And then funny enough, the week after, someone went amber. Then everyone's like, ooh, you're amber. And then in the back of their mind, they were thinking, actually, maybe we should be amber as well, because now we're all behind. And this is the same concept that I had before, is that, you know, the moment you realize that you're behind someone else, you're like, I actually want to get to that specific position. So you can see week 12, everyone, except the one person that didn't get it, was still red, but everyone went amber. And then after that, they started, you know, improving. Some people fell behind, so we have week 13, platform 3, that's the platform of the Riddler that I talked about before, went red. And then eventually week 15, everyone was green, everyone was happy. And then the next week we come in and we all turned amber. And I'm like, but everything is passing. And the dev manager says, aha, we're going to turn it up a notch, and now we're going to introduce static analysis. If you have any warnings, any static analysis warnings, you're going to go amber. And funny enough, platform 3 went red at that stage because their build was broken. And again, we started working and we fixed all the static analysis warnings. And then after that, when we all became green, turn it up a notch, security analysis is now on. You have to make sure you don't have any security warnings, and so on. Now, this wasn't really working, at least for me, because I've noticed that the dev manager always goes in at 8:30 on Monday morning, runs the builds, makes sure everything is okay, reports on the numbers, updates his spreadsheet, and then we have our meeting at 9:00. So all the developers, all the tech leads would fix their build at 8 a.m., right before he would run his queries, and then make sure it's green, and they would do things like remove some warnings or put some tags to ignore the warnings. They would actually put some, say, ignore those unit tests so that only the passing unit test would work, and then everything would turn green. And this is sort of cheating. This is not the attitude that we wanted. And of course, the dev manager would go, oh, wow, fantastic, you're going all green, it's all good. And then half an hour after the meeting, it all goes back into the previous state that it was in, and we would have this delay of a week to actually get back to where we should be. I'm like, but to me, it sounds like a little bit of waste of time. I mean, the information is in TFS. How easy is it to, you know, retrieve this information? It's actually really easy. TFS has an API. If you're using Visual Studio Online, you actually have the REST API, which is really easy to query. So I thought, all right, we're going to produce something that is a little bit more interactive. We're going to produce a dashboard. And our first iteration of the dashboard looks something like that. So if anyone attended my session last year at TechEd, I was demonstrating that, and I actually took it quite far. So what you would see in here is faces of our developers. They don't look like that, by the way. I've just blurred them to remove their identity. But you also see the build name at the top, and then you might see some additional information here and there, and then some numbers that would tell you something. And it was fantastic, because the moment someone checks in the code, that dashboard would pull TFS and realize there is a build in progress. So that build turns blue, and it actually, you know, shows a visual indication that something is happening. And then once the build is done, then it would either turn green, red, or amber based on the status that it's in, which is the same thing that was happening manually in those spreadsheets. And that was fantastic, because the moment someone would check in code, their face would appear in there, and if they broke the build, they go, ooh, you broke the build. And that was really good feedback. And it was really interesting to see that the entire team responsible for that platform would roll up the sleeves and go, we've done something wrong. And they would go and fix it straight away and then wait for the build. And then they would see that it turns green. And they're like, OK, we're good now. We can continue our work as we were. And that's exactly the attitude that I was looking for. It was really fantastic. In fact, at TechEd last year, I had something like that. I was demonstrating that. By the way, don't do that at home. It's really dangerous. Exposed wires with high voltages can kill someone. And that's probably why I wasn't allowed to do it at home, at work. But the concept behind it was that I'm going to wire that into a USB relay. And that would trigger lights on and off. So the demonstration that I did last year at TechEd was to switch a lava lamp on when the code fails, a red one. And the concept behind it was that if you check in code and you break the build, the lava lamp starts. And you know the lava lamp takes a little bit of time to actually start warming up and then start bubbling. But if you don't fix the code by the time it starts bubbling, then you buy muffins for the rest of the team. That was the rule. Yeah, some people like it, some people don't like it. I mean, I don't like to put too much pressure, but the idea behind this is that if you see something broken, you should go there and fix it as soon as possible, as opposed to ignore it. And the fact that we had the lava lamp was a good timer and a good visual indication on how much time is left. Now, during winter, it would take longer, which is an advantage. During summer, it would warm up faster, but that's all fine. So what sort of results did we get? It was actually, I was really pleased to see that our results were quite good. But one thing that did happen is that I had an increase of traffic around my desk by 70%. So everyone came to me and said, oh, I have a question for you. I'm like, oh, fantastic, I'm the tech lead, I can answer your question, what is it? They're like, what is that thing on your desktop? I'm like, it's a screen and it actually connects to TFS, it gives us some metrics about the build qualities and all of that. And people were really interested in it, and it's good that it actually attracted attention. And then a tech lead came to me, and I didn't put his build up there, and I did that on purpose. I wanted to see if he cares. So meet Robert. Robert was one of our very capable tech leads, and he came to me and he said, hey, that dashboard thing, it looks fantastic. Can you actually tell me more about it? And I explained how it works and all of that. He's like, I don't see my platform there. How can I get it up there? I'm like, oh, sure, I can help. And I had him. This is the attitude that I wanted. I wanted to see that people cared about their platforms. People wanted to see that visibility, and people actually wanted to work hard to see that and get the team to actually engage and work on it. And funny enough, I worked with his team, and we actually got the build up there, and then we had the visibility, and we had everything that we wanted. So we had about 10 platforms. Out of those 10 platforms, we had 8 that went green and 2 that were amber. And I'm not too worried about amber builds, and I'll tell you why. Sometimes you're going to inherit code that is legacy code, code that is really old, that was written in older version of Visual Studio when ReSharper was non-existent, and it used to be stored in Visual Source Safe, and over the time, the years, it got upgraded to newer versions. And the moment you switch on static analysis on those, you're going to get thousands and thousands of violations. Now, you can spend your time fixing them, but you know, as they say, if it's not broken, don't go and fix it. So the important thing of those AMP builds is to actually have a baseline. We knew the level that they were at. We were making sure we're not making it any worse. So any new code that we're introducing, make sure that this is kosher code, it's good quality, and so on. So those actually were really, really good metrics that we had. Now, just to summarize the vision that I had, I was looking at quality. Now, at the top of that quality, we had continuous integration. So people would check in their code, they would get all the nice bells and whistles and so on. On top of that, we had continuous delivery. Now, there's a very, very interesting story about that, but I'm not gonna steal Julian's thunder. I'm going to let him actually talk about it. It was about how we actually started pushing to different environments. So the moment you check in your code, you get some sort of a gated check-in that would check that all your unit tests are passing, that you know does a quick regression test and so on. And if things go green, then it pushes to a dev environment automatically. We also had some automatic pushes to test environments that would trigger as twice a week. So twice a week, again, it would grab all of that, you know, what they typically call nightly builds. We'll grab everything that it has in there, make sure it's kosher, and then pushes it to the test environment. And the testers knew that on the next morning when they get into work, they had a fresh build there. So there was a little bit of automation that we added in there, and that was really good. We had our unit tests that we talked about. We also had some good static analysis that was giving us visibility, and again, all of that was visible to the team. Goes back to the continuous integration in case something fails, visibility, and then the cycle goes on and on and on. So that was really good. So I'll let Julian talk a little bit about that story of his.
So did any of this work? Well, I gave you a couple of instances of metrics. We had direct problems, we had solutions for them. We created badges, and we had improvements, which was fantastic. But some things didn't work, right? I created badges that, you know, completely fell on their face and didn't work at all. And that's fine. It's okay. It's a learning process, right? And I'm still, you know, early days in my game designer profession, and I'm still learning the best mechanics and how to use them, how to apply them. But I want to tell you a story about the first challenge. And I think it was probably one of the most successful challenges we had. I had a development team at the time, and they had been almost complete with their getting their automated deployments working, but it wasn't quite there. So I took Rami aside and said, look, if I give you the day, can you do it? He was like, oh, maybe. I said, yeah, close enough, let's go. So I grabbed the entire team. I said, right, here's the challenge. I want an email at 2 o'clock, you know, this morning from the build server saying successfully built and deployed the application into dev. Do you accept? And if you do, if you get it, I'll give you 50 points, $50, and I'll buy the entire team coffee. Sure enough, they said yes, and off they went. About 4 o'clock that afternoon, Rami's head pops up above the screen. He's like, oh, I'm about to kick off the bill for the first time. I'm a little nervous. I said, you're a big boy, you'll be fine, click the button. And sure enough, I started getting emails from the server. 4 o'clock fail, 4:30 fail, 5 o'clock fail, 5:30 fail, 5:47 success. They'd done it. But it wasn't automated, so it didn't count. So I went home that night, woke up the next morning, and sure enough, I had an email from the build server. I forwarded it to Rami and said, don't tell anyone if you'd been successful or not. I get into work that day, walk into the stand-up, and I have developers leaning in. So did we do it? I said, grab your coats, I'm buying coffee. And the whole team burst into applause.
Just listening to it right now, I'm getting goosebumps. And I've listened to that story 100 times. I don't know if you guys felt it. But there's something personal about that story, at least to me. And I didn't do the work. I don't take credit for it. But it was all the teams that got together, everyone that really cared about their platform, everyone that cared about that challenge. Although we were just deploying to a dev environment, nothing will happen. The worst that will happen is that they won't have their coffee. But they really cared. They actually all got together, and we worked as a team. And then when Julian announced the results, you could see how happy everyone was that we've achieved that challenge collectively, not individually.
So to recap, I had a tech lead that's done hundreds, thousands of releases to production critical environments, and he was nervous. I had developers and testers leaning in to find out if we'd been successful, and I had an entire team burst into applause. I can't give you a metric to say 25% improvement in productivity for that day, but you can't tell me that team wasn't engaged. You can't tell me that team wasn't fully invested in the success of the outcome of that particular challenge. So where to next? Well, I like to think we're only just scraping the surface of things, and there's two areas I'd like to look to improve things. I'd like to look at the massively popular online games, the World of Warcraft and the Call of Duty, where teams are formed virtually coming together to solve a challenge and a problem. I'd like to be able to take that concept and apply it back to the teams working that I'm working with. So as opposed to, you know, storming a castle, taking whatever hill you have to take, it's more getting this feature released to production. How can we, you know, take those similarities and apply them? And the other thing I want to do is personalize the game. So I played a game a long, long, long time ago called Civilization. In Civilization, you take a fledgling tribe and you build it to this epic civilization at the end of it. And through the process, you get to pick technologies. And there's a technology roadmap. And as you pick certain technologies, you get certain benefits. I'd like to do the same thing with the badges game and allow developers, testers, BAs to have different badges that only they can earn to really personalize and change the experience for those individual people playing it. So yeah, there's plenty of room for improvement. And as I said, I think we're only just scratching the surface here.
Yeah, absolutely. There was always room for improvement. And even if you guys remember what the dashboard looked like when we first started, it wasn't very clear about what's happening. And we prototyped a new version that looked more like this. And we had more big fonts, clear metrics, so we know exactly what the one in the middle is. So we have unit tests, we have code coverage, we have StarCop warnings, for example. And on the left-hand side, you would actually see what the build in general, how it's behaving. So this is just a prototype that we started working on. And it was better. Now, just a quick word regarding code coverage. It's a difficult metric. Be very careful when you use it. From a previous experience a few years ago, when we introduced it and we had high numbers, like we want 70% of code coverage, we realized that there was a habit of actually writing unit tests just for the heck of covering, as opposed to actually a unit test that would do anything. So be careful about using those metrics. And at the end of the day, whatever works for you, whatever works for your organization. So we had lots of room for improvement. Now, in December last year, I finished my duties at that big project that we're working on. I'm not allowed to say what it is. And this is when I parted ways with Julian. For people that actually know me in the audience, I went on parental leave. I was sharing the parental leave with my wife, so she did the first 6 months. I was doing the next 6 months. And it was fantastic. I sort of unwinded. I called it a sabbatical, but I was actually taking care of my son. I grew a beard. I traveled to the US, had to shave the beard, came back to New Zealand, grew a beard again. It was fun, it was good, reflected on life and things like that. And then I went back to work, but I went back to my old team, not the team that I was working with Julian. And I was quite amazed to see that whatever we were talking about before, everything that we've done, got spread around Datacom really quickly. And then we started seeing posters of people having the same problem, people saying, update TFS. Yes, that means you. So people were not updating TFS and they're trying to get there. And they didn't have the luxury of time to actually build something as sophisticated as Julian had, but they also introduced some sort of gamification by having posters similar to that. So they had things like, the first goal that we're going to do is avoid spaghetti code. The second goal that we're going to have is packages. And then they had the branching strategy in there. I'm not sure if it's actually visible, but the first lock on the left-hand side has a bucket of KFC next to it. And the idea behind it was that once we get to that branching strategy that we wanted, you know, we're going to shout KFC for the rest of the team. And that was fantastic. It was really good to see that people are using those concepts, but without actually, you know, doing all the bells and whistles, but starting with something simple, starting with, you know, printouts, posters. And as you can see, there was quite a roadmap ahead of us, update the dashboard, use Visual Studio 2015, use NuGet packages, and throughout all of that, they actually had all those rewards that they wanted to win. But the reward was not the bucket of KFC or that movie ticket. The reward was actually setting up an environment that is really good for people to work in, something that is easy to maintain, and something that would sort of have a lot of benefits on the long run. And funny enough, a couple of months later, after I joined, Julian finished his duty in that other project, and he joined the team that I was in. And at that stage, I thought, all right, we have a fantastic team. Both Julian and I are there. The journey continues. So the message that I told you today is if you want a team of engaged people, treat them like rock stars and superheroes. I'm Rami, I was your host for today. This is Julian Virtue co-presenting with me today. Thank you very much for attending. It was a pleasure presenting to all of you.